Choosing to Die with Help from a Physician, One Family's Story. Maine's Death with Dignity Law went into effect pretty quietly in 2019. It passed the legislature by one vote after seven attempts at similar laws in the past. Since its passage, very few people have used the law. Epidemiologist and ALS patient Ron DePrez, who died in April, was only the second. His daughter helped him by researching the law and even picking up the drugs at the pharmacy for him. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Esme DePrez joins us to share her father's story and the reasons for his decision. We'll also talk with Ron DePrez's physician, a medical ethicist, and the executive director of Maine Death with Dignity. What are your questions about Maine's law, how it works, and its impact on families? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Maine's Death with Dignity Act allows for people to choose physician-assisted death when facing terminal illness. It went into effect in September of 2019. Today, we will hear the story of a Maine man who chose death with dignity, and we'll discuss difficult end-of-life questions. My guest, Esme DePrez, who is senior reporter for Bloomberg News. She's also the daughter of Ronald DePrez, whose story she will share with us. And Valerie Lovelace is executive director of Maine Death with Dignity. A little later, we will be joined by Ron DePrez's physician, Dr. Stephen Edwards. We invite your questions and comments, of course, email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both so much for joining us today. Valerie, I'm going to start with you. Maine passed, as I mentioned, the Death with Dignity Act in September of 2019. What exactly does it allow and what does it not allow?
Thank you very much for having me here. The law allows a capable, terminally ill adult with a six-month prognosis to request medication to hasten their death if they otherwise qualify. So the things that it allows, first of all, is the patient must have a terminal diagnosis with a six-month prognosis that has to be confirmed by two physicians. The patient has to be capable of making their own healthcare decisions. So in other words, this isn't something you can put in your advance directive for, you know, your relatives or your agent to help you with if you can't make decisions. So it's definitely a patient-directed care. There's a 15-day wait period followed by another 48-hour wait period. If either physician suspects that the patient may have difficulty with decision-making, they're required by law to refer that person to a mental health specialist for a full mental health assessment. And so that's the basics of the requirements. There's two verbal requests, a written request that the patient has to have witnessed with two witnesses, only one of whom can be related to the patient in any fashion. And that's the basic process.
And do we have a sense of how many people have used this law in the year and a half or a little longer than that since it's been in place in Maine?
Well, the state publishes an annual report. So we've only seen one annual report, and that was the 2019 report that covered the period of September through the end of the year. And that report indicated one person used the law. The state's report is not due out until the end of March for 2020. So I don't get to be involved in these decisions. You know, these are private decisions between patients and their families and clergy and physicians. And so I don't have a good guess. I know of about two or three, only because patients have contacted me. But otherwise, I really don't have a good feel for that.
But a very small number.
Extremely small number.
Esme, you are here to tell your father's story and how he chose to end his life. Start by telling us how he lived his life.
My dad was amazing. He was born in Lewiston, lived most of his life in the Portland area, and then eventually moved up to Deer Isle. But he grew up poor in the Payson Park area. He became a Harvard-trained epidemiologist who founded a public health research and consulting firm and a nonprofit in downtown Portland that focused on rural communities. And he did work across the state and across the world. He was actually on this show a few years ago talking about population health. He was also super physically active. He was a star football player at Cheverus. And then in college, he was a former president of the Maine Track Club. He ran 18 marathons. You know, he hiked and summited mountains across the continent. He biked, he skied, he swam, he rock climbed. He did yoga well into his 70s. I mean, he really could do it all. He was, I call him a testament to the idea that if you work hard enough at something, you can really do just about anything.
How did he come to realize, and how did you come to realize that he was ill with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease? And what was that like for him and for your family?
ALS is just a horrible, horrible neurological disease that is incurable. It just slowly ate away at his body. So he really saw the decline, his body decline over the last year of his life. It slowly became, you know, harder and harder to walk. It became harder and harder to use his arms. So by the time he died in April of last year, I mean, he had always said, you know, if I get to the point where I can't feed myself, kind of that's the line in the sand. And he had begun dropping his fork at that point, and a number of expletives would follow. So he just didn't, you know, he just didn't want to live that way. He had, by that time, he needed help to, you know, do a lot of daily functions, daily activities, because ALS had just betrayed this body that he had worked all these years and decades to really keep care of and take care of. And ALS really snatched that away from him.
I understand that he tasked you with doing the research about physician-assisted death and ways that he might end his life. What a huge responsibility and difficult responsibility for you, Esme.
Yeah, he did need help with just navigating the law. I mean, the law is so new in Maine, and you know, at that point, just one other person we think had done it. So his physician, as you said, who will be on later, you know, had never done this before either. So it was really just a big education for all of us and trying to figure out how to navigate this law. And there are a lot of, you know, built-in delays and requirements, as Val detailed. So I actually got in contact with Val during the process, which was incredibly helpful just to help me kind of figure out, okay, what do we need to do here in order to get him qualified? And it was, you know, a crazy thing to do, but it was what my dad wanted and what he asked of me. And this is the way that he wanted to, you know, to end his life. He didn't want to just, you know, continue wasting away and be dependent on a bunch of people. He was an independent spirit his whole life. And so he wanted to remain that in death. And that's what this law was able to give us.
Can you describe what it was like when he died?
He'd been living in the Portland area with his girlfriend probably for the past year of his life as he declined, and she really took wonderful care of him. But he wanted to die in Deer Isle. That was his favorite place in the world and the place where he'd bought a home back in 2010. And so my husband and my brother and my 13-month-old at the time daughter, we took him up to Deer Isle and just spent it was quite short. I mean, we had about a day and a half with him up there, and it was a beautiful time of looking at old photos and reciting poetry and listening to his favorite songs. And, you know, he was really at ease at that point. I mean, he had been really anxious up until qualifying for the law because it was just so scary to think of, you know, the prolonged death, the awful prolonged death that he may have experienced with ALS had, you know, this law not been available or not been available to him. But of course, in the end, he was able to make use of it. And so as soon as we got the drugs, which was just a couple days before, his mind was completely at ease. He knew that he, you know, this decision was in his hands, that it was in his control, and that he could decide to use it when he was ready. And so we had a wonderful last day or two with him, especially of just being able to have our dad back and have him be at peace with his decision.
So here we are, several months out and almost a year since that day. Are you at peace with the decision and your role in it?
His request for sure at first was hard to hear. I didn't want him to die ever, of course, none of us do, but it was really a no-brainer, I would say, from the 5 minutes after he asked me if I would help him, because this is what he wanted. And, you know, I could give that gift to my dad of a quote unquote good death. And I would say in the aftermath, and obviously it was tremendously difficult in the moment, but in the months that followed, you know, as the pandemic is just causes these awful lonely deaths in hospitals where people are alone, you know, I just came to be so grateful for this, for the way he could die. He was surrounded by his family in a place that he loved, and, you know, he had a quote unquote good death. I mean, what more could you ask for? So this was the complete opposite of these awful COVID deaths. And that is such a gift to us and to him.
Valerie, as you listen to Esme's story, is her story similar to other stories you've heard?
It is. I mean, I just am so moved listening to how this law helped support Esme and her dad. And I still, there's times when I still have to pinch myself to recognize that it's real, that, you know, we were able to bring this to Maine to help patients and their families with their end of life wishes. And it's just it is an amazing, humbling thing to hear.
Esme's father, as we mentioned, had ALS. Are the patients who come to you, is ALS one of the more common reasons?
Well, when you look at the data over the past 25 years from all of the states who have enacted these laws, the vast majority of patients have terminal cancer, and there's about anywhere from 8 to 10, 11% of folks who have neurological diseases like ALS.
All right. Joining us on the line now is Dr. Frank Chessa, who is Director of Clinical Ethics for Maine Medical Center. Thanks so much for calling in, Dr. Chessa.
Hi. Yeah, my pleasure.
I understand that within the medical community, this is a really difficult discussion. And I'm wondering if you can talk to me about what some of the difficult moral or ethical questions are raised by the idea of assisting someone's death, prescribing these medications.
Sure. You're right. It's, you know, I think anytime you are taking care of somebody who's seriously ill and you're considering focusing on comfort and quality of life rather than life prolonging therapy, for a physician, that's a huge responsibility, because you're a moral agent in somebody's decision making around essentially when they're going to die. And death with dignity or medical assistance in dying is not an exception to that. So it's, I think most physicians feel a huge responsibility in, you know, all of these end of life decisions and sharing the decision making with patients.
Dr. Chess, I know the law went into place in September of 2019, but the big health organizations in the state, including yours, it took a while, didn't it, months, to actually come up with some guidelines for your own medical staff.
Yeah, I think, you know, like the public, who is, you know, divided, I think, on this controversial issue, we wanted to make sure that we had a full discussion at Maine Medical Center and Maine Health. You know, hearing input from many constituencies around our health system to think about what to do. And then once we decided that we were going to, you know, as an institution, allow our physicians the option of participating in this, which is what the law says that medical institutions should decide whether their physicians can participate or not. You know, we wanted to make sure that we were doing it in the best possible way. So we researched some of the pharmaceuticals that were involved. We thought about some of the best communication techniques. We essentially we built a process that we felt was best practice in this area. And that did take a little bit of time to build. I think we were, it was maybe 6 months between when the law went into effect and when we were ready to take our first patient.
Mm. What about fears that the Death with Dignity Act would prompt the likelihood of abuse or misuse of the law? Do you see that happening, Dr. Chessa?
Well, with any end-of-life situation where, as I said, you're making these decisions that are, you know, hugely impactful for families, there's always the potential for the process not to go well, family members not to feel like they're not being heard, patients are in a tough situation because not only are they making these tough decisions, but they're sick and they're ill at the time, and so it's difficult. So the process is, you know, filled with sorts of ethical questions that could come up. With Death with Dignity, I guess my biggest concern, and one that's been written about, is concern that financial considerations sort of force people into this option. I know Esme wrote a wonderful article about her dad. I really appreciated it. She spoke about how, you know, thinking about finances were part of the decision here. And of course, we think about finances all the time when we're making decisions in life. But I'd hate to see somebody's back up against the wall and they're choosing Death with Dignity because, say that, you know, the medical bills are just too much and they're trying to save a home for a surviving spouse or something like that. Mm.
So, Esme, I want to bring you into the conversation there, since you did write about that. What are your thoughts about that part of this discussion?
Well, the concern, just overall, I would say, the concern that people are going to do this based on financial decisions or be coerced because, you know, their families are worried about their financial decisions. There's just not been any evidence of that. I did research that, you know, a lot, and there have been studies that have been shown that show no incentive there. And also, I mean, there's no incentive on the bigger macroeconomic level for governments to push these kind of laws. There was a seminal study back in 1998 in the New England Journal of Medicine that found that it would, you know, even if a medical aid in dying laws were legalized nationwide, the overall health care system would save a fraction of healthcare spending. So there's just no real economic incentive there. And for my dad, I mean, it was not a financial decision for him. Look, he didn't want to die. He didn't want to live with ALS and, you know, in this body that he didn't recognize, in this life that he didn't recognize. Now, I do say in the piece that, you know, he didn't want to, again, he was born poor. He was able to create this, you know, comfortable middle-class life for himself. He didn't want to waste all his money on care, but it wasn't about, that was really about living a life that he didn't want to live. You know, I mean, had he been able to spend a lot of money to maintain a life that he wanted, then he would have done that. So it wasn't, I wouldn't add kind of a financial incentive into the bucket of the reasons why he did this. It just that was just there alongside at the same time.
Dr. Chessa, do you know physicians who have decided to opt out and not take part?
Sure. Plenty. In fact, I think the more difficult situation is finding physicians who are willing to opt in. And there are many across the state who are opting in, but it's I think there's a sense of standing back and seeing how this goes for the first couple of years. It's not a process or procedure that physicians are familiar with. So there's the sense of kind of a wait and see. I would say more physicians are either opting out for moral reasons or opting out really just because it's new and not something they feel competent to be able to do. Mm. So really the finding physicians willing to do this, I think, is a challenge for patients these days. I also want to say I agree with everything Esme said about the finances. My point would just be that kind of fully funding palliative care and, you know, all medical treatment across the state is maybe just as important as, you know, as making this available to folks so that folks have an option.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was Dr. Frank Chessa, who is Director of Clinical Ethics at Maine Medical Center. We're going to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Cumberland Crossing, a new retirement community offering access to Ocean View at Falmouth's Care Continuum, CumberlandCrossingRC.com. There will be a Maine CDC briefing today with Dr. Nirav Shah this afternoon at 2. The briefings are currently on a Tuesday-Thursday schedule. Tune in to Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, or the Maine Public Facebook page at 2 this afternoon for the live update. The CDC briefings are also archived on our website for later on-demand viewing. You can find the link on the television dropdown at MainePublic.org. Once again, the Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus today at 2 on Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and on Facebook.
Ever wonder why a garden snake feels so much scarier than invisible threats like viruses?
The modern world has a whole different array of hazards from the ancient world, and a lot of these modes of thinking were shaped in the cave, so to speak.
Why we're often scared of the wrong things. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Join us for Hidden Brain this evening at 10 o'clock.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about Maine's Death with Dignity law, what it means and what questions it raises. We're also hearing from a woman whose father chose this law. Valerie Lovelace is Executive Director of Maine Death with Dignity, and Esme Deprez is an investigative journalist whose father chose physician assistance to end his life. You can share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now, Dr. Stephen Edwards, who is a family practice physician and was the doctor who prescribed the medication for Ron Deprez. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Edwards.
You're welcome. Good morning.
I understand you were already Ron Deprez's physician when he asked you if you would assist with his death. Tell us how you felt about that. Was it a difficult decision?
I was familiar with him. I've been caring for him for some time. He was not someone I saw very often. He was very healthy. So this was obviously a very difficult thing for him to manage and to deal with. And you know, because this was his choice and it was an option that we were able to provide for him, I felt personally fairly comfortable in having the conversation with him about it.
How is it from the doctor's side to proceed under Maine's Death with Dignity Act? I know Valerie's talking about how many steps there were and waiting periods for the patient to go through and certain to be sure that that's what they want. Are there that many checks and steps for the physician as well?
There, it's a very well outlined procedure that we're asked to follow as far as that goes. So there's not a, there weren't any difficulties in that aspect, and it was very clearly outlined. So from a procedural standpoint, it was quite simple.
Okay. What is the actual prescription medication or set of medications, and how does it work?
That's a big question, I guess. There is a protocol called DDMA, which is what was recommended here in Maine. So the fatal, if you would, fatal dose of medication includes something called digoxin and a benzodiazepine called diazepam, as well as a narcotic painkiller called morphine, and then a tricyclic antidepressant called amitriptyline. And there's an anti-nausea and an anti-emetic medication used to help sort of stabilize the patient while they're taking those.
You heard Dr. Frank Chessa say that many physicians may be hesitant to do this, in part because if it's new. What would you say to them, or what have you said to them?
to other physicians or to patients?
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
To other physicians who are grappling with whether to follow in your footsteps.
Well, I think it's a challenging and difficult question, I think. The procedure seems to be well vetted from what I understood and from what I understand and have seen from my research. So procedurally, it seems fairly straightforward. There is the, you know, the moral and the professional questions that come up with this. And I suppose it's more important that it's a personal decision between the patient and their provider as far as how to proceed. And it's an individual decision on a case-by-case basis.
Sure. You know, people who have maybe not followed this closely may be familiar with the term euthanasia and think of somebody like Jack Kevorkian. This is an entirely different thing, isn't it? And can you explain the difference?
I can try. This, as I understand it, death with dignity is allowing the patient to end their life in the setting of a terminal diagnosis in a way and manner that they seem fit and is fair and compassionate. Euthanasia, I equate with something like a mercy killing, and I'm not someone I think who could give a better definition of that, but this is something that enables patients and empowers patients to make the choices that they seem fit to make rather than imposing something upon somebody.
Mm. Dr. Edwards, I understand you can stay on the line for the rest of the program and help answer questions from our listeners, and I appreciate that. And Valerie, I want to turn to you with that same question. Explain to us what the conversation is today and what we're talking about today and how that differs from the conversation in the 80s.
Sure. I'm not sure what you're referring to.
What I mean is the term euthanasia. What is the difference between what Maine's Death with Dignity Act does and what people may imagine that it does?
Got it. So you know, as Dr. Edwards pointed out, the Death with Dignity Act allows the patient to make their own decision, receive the medication, take it home, and use it if and when they choose to use it. Euthanasia is when a someone else takes an action on the body of the other person. So euthanasia is how we put our pets to sleep. You know, somebody else makes the decision. Somebody else administers the medication, normally by injection. And this is not that. This is ingested medication at the hands of the patient themselves. So it either goes in by mouth or feeding tube, if that's what they have, how they take food and everything into their digestive system. And it's solely a patient decision.
Valerie, is this we've done many Maine Calling programs on hospice and palliative care. Is this an either or can hospice and palliative care work hand in hand with someone who's chosen death with dignity?
That's a great question. It is definitely a both and. And I think a lot of people have the misconception that it's either hospice and palliative care or you could choose this. But in fact, hospice and palliative care is highly recommended, really helps with your quality of life for as long as possible, manages your symptoms for as long as possible. And then in the end, if the patient also chooses to use this, to hasten their death by the last, you know, few days or a week or so, it's perfectly compatible. And if you look at the data collection in the state of Oregon and Washington and other states who have this law in place, those who are collecting on hospice, it shows about 90% of the patients who receive the medication are also enrolled in and receiving hospice and palliative support.
Mm. And Esme, was that a conversation you had with your father about hospice?
My dad actually was on hospice at the time, so mm-hmm. he was on that. And I just wanted to also add that, I mean, the U.S. is really an anomaly in a sense of having the structure of the medical aid and dying laws that we have here. So as Val was saying, no U.S. state law authorizes euthanasia when the doctor physically administers the drugs, but all or parts of 10 countries in the world have something, have assisted death laws or assisted death as legal there. And a lot of them actually do have euthanasia and or medical aid in dying. So they have both. So that the U.S. is a little different than a lot of the rest of the countries in the world. And I would just I would say, I mean, you know, when somebody else administers the drugs, it can still be the patient's decision. So, for example, in Canada, euthanasia is actually really widely used there, much more so than the medical aid and dying laws that we have here in the U.S.
We're going to go to Stephanie calling from Newcastle. Hi, Stephanie. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to thank Esme for telling her dad's story. My partner, Eric Carlson, used the Death with Dignity law at the end of October. He was a day after his 50th birthday when he died as per his wishes. He had also suffered a terrible diagnosis of glioblastoma and had fought it for 18 months, which is also incurable brain cancer. And I just really also appreciate Valerie being there and having the physician speak on record because Eric's story was actually on New Center Maine with Cindy Williams. And despite the wonderful support of his physicians, nobody was willing to go on camera to speak about it. And I just feel so strongly that people in our state need to know that this is a choice. Eric was a really, really healthy, independent guy. He was a forester. He fought fires as a hotshot out west. And similar to Esme's story about her dad, he wanted to die on his own terms the way he lived on his own terms.
Stephanie, thank you so much for calling in, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Dr. Edwards, and what Stephanie says rings true. Here at Maine Calling, we've been wanting to have this discussion and do this program for a long time and have not had physicians step forward to talk about it. Why are you doing it?
I think that this is an important option for people to have. I feel fairly strongly about that, that this is an empowering, you know, option to have at the end of life, and it's important for people and their loved ones and families to be or to have this available to them.
Mm. Why do you think the discomfort?
I think that, you know, death is never an easy subject to bring up, to deal with, whether it's particularly your own, you know, but it's not a conversation that we're used to having in the United States. In my experience. So it can just be very challenging.
Mm. Well, Stephanie, I really appreciate you calling in and joining us today. And again, so sorry for your loss. Sounds like your partner was a wonderful, wonderful guy. We're going to go to Herbert calling from Athens. Hi, Herbert. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say I thought it was kind of quite a bad idea to make a law that would, you know, enable to people to wipe themselves out, because I think a lot of times people really don't get all the proper information. You know, doctors are trained in, quote, commercial medicine, and I personally have lived as long as I have because I've gone to non-commercial medicine, like live food diet and cutting oxidizers out of my diet, and no doctor that was trained by, quote, the medical establishment really gets that type of information trained to them. You know, live food has enzymes. Whenever you cook food, you kill your enzymes. So anyway, my really good example is my dad was in the hospital once, and they were about to put on a do not resuscitate bracelet on him. And my sister was there, I was there, and my sister said, "What's that?" And they said, "It's a do not resuscitate thing." And she said right to my dad, is that what you want?" And he said, "No, I've never asked for that." And so there's a lot of times.
So Herbert, is what you're saying is that you're worried that people will not be given all of their options or will not be exactly presented with all of their options before being presented with this option?
Yeah, that's part of it. And I've actually been injected at least 4 times with things that did me harm. And twice I absolutely explained I didn't want that stuff injected into me.
Sure. Okay. I think I understand. So, yeah. Esme, you wanted to respond to this.
Yeah, Herbert, I mean, I'm so glad that you are healthy and that you have been able to maintain your health. I would just say you don't know what it's like. I mean, nobody knows what it's like to be in the situation until you're in it. And when you're faced with a terminal illness, I mean, my dad was a Harvard-trained epidemiologist, expert in public health. He knew exactly what he was facing. He knew exactly what his care options were. So misinformation or lack of information was definitely not the issue here. It was simply a matter of wanting to take control over the situation and be in control of his death as he was in his life. And, you know, for everybody that is healthy and is able to live past the age of 75, which was the age of my dad when he died, I mean, more power to them and God bless. But I just would say that, you know, it's really hard to understand the decision made by individuals when faced with really unique circumstances or not so unique circumstances. But we can never know what it's like for another person. And I would just caution against, making judgment upon people that do decide to take this path when they feel like it's the right decision for them.
Yeah, and before we go to a break, Dr. Edwards, I want to give you a chance to respond to Herbert as well.
Well, I think that, having the choice is vital in this. And in the case of his father, with the choice being taken away, that sounds, terrible. And I can't imagine that happening. I can't imagine watching that happen. So, again, something like this is about empowering the individual. So, which is, I think, the most important part of the Death with Dignity Act and its capabilities here in Maine.
All right. Well, we are going to take another quick break. We're speaking about Maine's Death with Dignity law. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bristol Seafood, a Maine company whose mission is to make seafood America's favorite protein. Learn more at bristolseafood.com.
I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. The Biden administration continues to press for a new COVID relief package. We'll have the latest.
Also, the Washington Post's stalwart executive editor, Marty Baron, announces his retirement from the paper. That's next time on Here and Now.
And join us for Here and Now, coming up in a few minutes at 12 noon. You have the power to make a difference in your community, and now your impact can go twice as far. On Wednesday, we'll launch our Pledge from Home Community Impact Drive, and for every donation made to Maine Public, Maine Community Foundation will donate 33 meals to Good Shepherd Food Bank. That means you will not only be investing in the trusted news and information you count on, you'll also be helping to fight food insecurity in Maine during this historic time. Good Shepherd Food Bank serves all 16 counties in Maine, providing more than 27 million meals to children, families, and seniors last year. That's the Pledge from Home Community Impact Drive beginning tomorrow right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and we are discussing physician-assisted death and difficult end-of-life decisions. My guest, Esme Deprez, whose father chose death with dignity. Esme is a journalist. And Dr. Stephen Edwards, Ron Deprez's physician, plus Val Lovelace, executive director for Maine Death with Dignity. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. I want to go to a couple emotional emails that have come in since the beginning of this program. This one is from Don. Don writes, I am so grateful that Death with Dignity is available now. My mother passed away before it was an option in 2015. After a high-speed drive, after receiving a call from a nurse, I held my mom's swollen, cool, and otherwise lifeless hand while she took her final breaths. My sister raced in her car to join us. She was gurgling and struggling for air, unable to communicate anything whatsoever. I hoped she could hear my final words. She had cancer and knew she would die. Earlier, she asked her doctor how it might all unfold, communicating her wish was to have both of her children beside her as she passed. Her doctor hoped that would happen, but as we listened, it was clear it was out of the doctor's hands. The family just waited and hoped it might all work out. In the end, my mother suffered for breath and was catatonic, her children racing through traffic. She was robbed of her wish to pass present with her children beside her. And then an email from Sue, who wrote, My husband used the Death with Dignity law last spring. It was a blessing to him because he was able to choose the how and when he died after receiving a diagnosis of stage 4 cancer. Because his family also knew when he would die, they were able to call him, visit with him, say goodbye, and for those of us in the area to be at his bedside. The palliative care doctor and home nurse were supportive of his choice, and we're there with this day. My thanks to the legislators who brought this law into effect and the doctors and nurses who support patients who make this choice. Before we move on, Esme, I was wondering if you had a reaction to those emails.
That first email, I mean, makes me think I've gotten so much. So my story about my dad ran or is in this week's Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, and I have gotten more reader response via email and via Twitter and other platforms than, you know, by far than any other story. And I was really anticipating, you know, some blowback. And of course, there's been a tiny bit of that. But really, I've been struck by the number of messages I've gotten from people telling me about just the awful deaths that their loved ones have lived and, you know, how thankful they are for this option. And it's been overwhelming in the best way. But I've heard a lot of stories like the first email about just how awful, you know, death can otherwise be. And it just makes me, again, even more grateful that we had this option where my dad didn't have to endure a prolonged, painful death that would have been, you know, awful to experience for him and awful to watch for his family and those of us, you know, who loved him. So my heart goes out to that gentleman who had to watch his wife suffer like that. It's just no way. You know, suffering is no way to live. It's no way to die either.
Valerie.
Yes. I am, I cannot begin to describe the number of stories I heard throughout the 5.5 years of working here in the state to get this law passed of the way people have suffered and died. Some of them so tragic, I wish I could unhear the stories, actually. And so, you know, to the second email and to Esme's story, and excuse me, it's kind of emotional. And Stephanie calling in, the fact that people don't have to suffer that way anymore if this is a path they want to choose and a decision that aligns with their values, for me is just immeasurable.
Valerie, one thing that's so interesting to me is, you know, I've been a reporter in Maine a long time, and I know how many times this has come up both before the legislature and then also in public referendum campaigns. And what it's curious to me that for as emotional as those campaigns were, as difficult as they were, the law has come into being and it's been very quiet. Are you surprised by that? Are you surprised that something that was so emotional and controversial and loudly contested sort of has just become this quiet reality?
Yeah, and I'm not actually surprised by that. It happens in every state. There's a, you know, a really big crescendo of you know, all kinds of emotional angst around passage of the law, and then when the law goes into effect and physicians choose to opt in and patients begin asking questions of their physicians, it just sort of organically becomes a part of the continuum of end-of-life care that that people privately discuss with their physicians.
And do you have thoughts on that, Dr. Edwards?
I'd have to agree with Linda that it you know, becomes this private conversation that you have. So it doesn't have a place out there in the airwaves on that individual level. I think that it can certainly be brought that way through some discussion, but it does tend to exist just in a quiet presence for the most part.
I have an email here from Renata. Does this law apply to cases of dementia? How is the question of prognosis handled? Valerie.
The law actually does not, is not for patients with dementia. You know, as the law states, you have to have a terminal diagnosis, 6-month prognosis, and capacity to make an informed decision. In my experience in the home care industry, by the time a dementia patient is within 6 months of dying, they're generally speaking, their capacity for decision making has long
since gone.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to Delia calling from Thomaston. Hi, Delia. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Jennifer. I just wanted to talk about my mom who passed away many years ago, and 5 years ago, and she had cancer, and she had. We all knew my family was there. We were there for weeks on end. My sister was a hospice nurse, and she took care of her. It was beautiful that we all got to be together and be with my mom. But you know, at the end, I would say in the last 5 days, she wanted to go, and we all wanted her to go, to be done with the pain and the suffering. And she didn't have this choice. And I just think it's amazing that, you know, that choice is there now. And maybe she wouldn't have taken it because she was the devout Catholic. So, but the point is that she didn't have that choice. And I would have loved for her to have chosen, you know, been able to choose.
You know, something very interesting I learned from you, Esme, is that of the people who are prescribed the medication, many don't take it. And it's the peace of mind that Delia is talking about that she wished her mother would have had.
Yeah, the data show that about 1/3 of Americans who obtain these prescriptions for lethal drugs don't actually end up using them. So, you know, people like Val will say that this really underscores how much comfort and peace people can find in just having this option. And I can speak for my dad. In particular, I mean, that was absolutely the case. He was in such an anxious fog of pain and anxiety, I guess, prior to getting qualified for this law. He just didn't know how his life would end. And then, of course, obviously, he did end up, you know, qualifying. And that just brought him such a sense of relief that he could have control over his end, just as he had done throughout his life. And I mean, I think one of the themes here is about control. I mean, for the most part, we get to be in control of our lives. But when it comes to our deaths, you know, that is very less often, you know, far less often the case. You know, control gets ceded to doctors who work within this medical system that has all these tools to prolong our lives, which, you know, have been amazing and miraculous for so many people. But it really doesn't, you know, often let people end their lives the way that they wish. And sometimes families, you know, don't want to see their loved ones go. And so when it came to my dad, I mean, you know, I couldn't change his decision about how and when to die. He was in control. His terminal illness had stolen so much of his life and his freedom and his independence. But with this law, he could still be in control of his death. And that was really important for him.
Delia, thank you for calling in, and I'm so sorry to hear about your mother's death. We're going to go to Norman calling from Vassalboro. Hi, Norman, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell my story about my mom who lived in California and had a neck brain injury from an ambulance ride. And because it was not a terminal diagnosis, she wasn't able to get an assisted death in California. So what ended up happening is she lived, you know, 10 years in pain, traveled the country to get, you know, to get help from pain pumps that ended up paralyzing her to brain operations and paying $20,000 a month for fentanyl. To where, you know, it kind of bankrupted the whole family and the home and everything else. So I would, you know, a thought would be that it's just not, doesn't have to be a chronic, you know, imminent death diagnosis that, you know, after a certain amount of time, you know, do you want your family member just laying in a bed with a, you know, with a crane by their side, and her being a nurse, you know, she knew she wanted to go, you know, she ended up taking her life, after the second attempt, you know, but 10 years of moaning and, you know, listening to the family at the kitchen table when they're in the bed, you know, year after year after year. I think people just need to think, you know, what's the dignified way to go? And
Norman, yeah. Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry. What a horrible, horrible time your mother had. And Valerie, yeah, let me ask you about that, because as you mentioned, Maine's law is very specific, 6 months, a prognosis of 6 months or less. Do you believe this ought to be the next step, that you don't have to have that prognosis to make this choice?
I think about this all the time, and I get asked about it all the time. Unfortunately, here in the United States, the current laws are specifically for terminally ill individuals. I do think there's plenty of room for more discussion and more work around end-of-life options and what it could look like or what it should look like. But these, not only are they controversial issues, but there are legal and medical and ethical questions that really come into play at a much broader level than with a terminal illness and a six-month prognosis. So, you know, it's anybody's guess how the course of these discussions will continue in our country. You know, I can only hope to see in my lifetime, you know, additional options for end of life that make a patient's death meaningful to them and their family.
Dr. Edwards, anything to add to that?
I think, as Valerie said, this is a contentious point, or I should say better, a point that does require more discussion. There's not an easy answer to that, unfortunately. But when you're looking at these essentially non-terminal concerns, I mean, pain is such a challenging thing to deal with on an everyday basis for many patients and as providers and their families. So it is something that is certainly worthy of discussion, but I don't think there's a clear answer in sight right now.
And Norman, thank you so much for your call. Esme, we just have a few seconds left. I'm just wondering if you have some final words of wisdom for someone who may find themselves in your shoes in the future. What do you wish you'd known?
Oh, wow. That's a big question. The best part of my dad's death was just being able to give him the death that he wanted, and having to come to terms with this idea that he was in control, that I was not, that nobody else in his life was, you know, was. I mean, it was really up to him. He, like I said, he'd been in control of his life throughout his life, and he should be in control of his death. But coming to terms with that was not an easy decision, or it was not an easy thing to do, but I think it was the right thing to do, and that's why I feel so grateful that you know, he was able to do that.
Well, we have posted your article on our Facebook page and online, and I encourage people to read it. That was Esme DePrez, a reporter with Bloomberg News and daughter of Ronald DePrez. Also, Dr. Stephen Edwards has been with us, family practice physician, and Val Lovelace with Maine Death with Dignity. Today's sound engineer was John Keimel. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.